Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you? State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the Morning right now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Wong. How are you?
Good morning. Fantastic. Thank you for having me on.
Yes. Well, I want to do a deep dive today because I find that this is something that the news, I don't know, will get it all right. And I want to make sure that people aren't relying on reading it in the newspaper or watching it on television. Like, I want people to really understand when you see words in headlines like more affordable or cheaper or more coverage options. I want to make sure they really understand it because I think too often we can be misguided. And I think this could be a really big deal if, in fact, this passes the way it is. So we're talking about the public health option. First of all, correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like Democrats were actually crafting this bill behind closed doors for a couple of weeks. And then they just released it to the Republicans last Thursday. Am I correct on that? And if so, that sounds really sketchy.
Well, that is part of the residual of one-party rule. Let me be clear that Democrats and Republicans share a common goal of reducing the skyrocketing burden and cost of health care insurance, and that health insurance is an incredibly personal and critical element, particularly in this environment of COVID and our health concerns. So let's put that as a baseline, that there is no partisanship. There should never be partisanship to try to address the skyrocketing cost of health care insurance. The difference is how we go about it.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, indeed, Melissa, I'm very concerned about the issue of transparency, about the issue of getting input from all of the interested shareholders. And the reason I say that is you're required by statute for a public hearing of this kind of magnitude and impact that you have 5 days of public notice. Well, conveniently, it was released on Friday. That counts as Saturday and Sunday has the 5 days, which in normal practices shouldn't be applicable. The bill had been crafted and worked on, and from what I understand, had been shared and spoken with many of the shareholders that seem to have a very strong interest supporting it, whereas myself, as the ranking Republican leader on the committee, never saw it.
So you never saw it. That's the big thing I'm taking. So, like, exactly. You are the ranking member of this committee specifically. You did not see it till when?
Friday.
That's crazy.
It was released to the general public as by statute for the public hearing of the 5-day requirement. Again, they're following to the rule of the law, but unfortunately, the lack of transparency, the lack of collaboration, and really earnestly looking for input from all interested shareholders really reminds me over and over again how we passed the police bill, how simply the fact of one-party rule could really, in this environment of COVID and not being in the building and our limited access to this kind of information is troubling at best and very, very much trying to pull the wool over people whose lives will be impacted by the laws that
mm-hmm.
we make.
Mm-hmm.
And I will simply say this. I think the fundamental difference, even though we believe in the common goal, I believe the fundamental difference in how we approach reducing health care insurance costs is the Democrat perspective of a state government-run program, a state takeover of our health insurance program versus, in my opinion, a need for a free market collaboration along with government to try to reduce costs and truly understand the true cost of healthcare, which is so complicated. But if I can break it down into simple points,
make me understand, like, what
state government.
Exactly. I was going to say, can you break down, like, sort of really the difference between what it seems like the Democrats want to do versus what the Republicans are proposing?
Well, I will say this, I'll caveat. The Affordable Care Act, the Federal Affordable Care Act, has been a challenge to fully understand, and the implications are still very much felt to this day.
Yeah.
Are there many things that occurred from it? Absolutely. I think one of the things we all agree is pre-existing condition coverage. But the increased impact on the cost of health insurance were so incrementally compounded that no one has argued the fact that our health care insurance has increased. But the factor is that it may be in part due to the well-intentioned idea of the Affordable Care Act. And what we're looking at right now in the Democratic proposal may be, again, very well-intentioned. But health care doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is not a market theory. It is deeply personal, and it is costly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the difference is, if you're looking to create a statewide system that may be kind of a Medicare and Medicaid system, as they articulate it, and one of the formats that they'd like to emulate is putting a lot of people into a program that we have in Connecticut that has worked extremely well. It's called a Husky program. It provides insurance, affordable insurance for those that are economically struggling or do not qualify to be able to pay on the open market. It is an affordable health insurance. But the trouble with Husky is this. You have significantly less choice in regards to your doctor, in regards to the procedures that you can have, and the services and the quality that and the variety that you may have. So if we're going to put our public option system and put people by mandating that they participate in a state takeover of our health insurance, we need to fully understand the impact and the potential loss of choice that people will have. Look, it sounds great. I want to have and be able to provide quality, the highest standard health insurance and health care coverage to everyone.
Of course.
But unfortunately, reality sets in, and there is a cost. And how we manage that cost is truly the difference. We believe, as Republicans, that the free market, I mean, look, we have the best insurance talent in the world. We're not known as the insurance capital of the world
for nothing.
And we have great resources of brokers and information advocates that educate people about these things. What we're looking to do, the Democrats are looking to do, my mind is, literally take that system and say, the state can take over and do a better job.
No kidding.
That, to me, is the fundamental difference. We all agree that health insurance costs need to be contained. I approach it that we need to have free market forces and the people that are on the ground doing it best versus state government taking it over.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? We're going to dive more into these specifics because that's one of the key things that I'm noticing. If you look at recent state reports, Senator Huang, it looks like tens of thousands of insurance carrier and related full-time employees here in Connecticut would be at risk of losing their jobs if, in fact, this does pass. So we're going to talk about that and many other aspects of this with Senator Tony Huang. He's going to be back with us right at 7:30.
What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you. State Senator Tony Huang joins Melissa in the Morning right now on WICC 600.
And we are continuing our conversation with State Senator Tony Huang this morning about this public health option that's being debated on in Hartford. And coming up at the end of this segment, we'll tell you about how you can get involved and hear the testimonies and testify yourself. Senator Huang, welcome back to the show. This is a 35-page document. And as many of my listeners know, my husband and my father are brokers here here in Connecticut. They're right here in Fairfield. My husband combed through this document, and he brought a lot of key items to my attention, and I wanted to share some of them and talk to you about them on the air. First of all, it sounds like the answer, one of the big answers, is basically getting more people onto Husky, which, while it's very helpful, no one voluntarily says one day, like, I want to be on Husky. A lot of times it's because of situations or circumstances that they end up on Husky. So it's not what I would call the most quality insurance, if you will. And I don't even know how people of like the middle class caliber could even qualify for this kind of health insurance. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Indeed, Husky has been an important support and resource of affordable health care insurance. But it is significantly less in choice regards to doctors, procedures, and services. And you know, people really need to better understand the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. And we always like to think that it is a solution for all the healthcare cost challenges we have. We say, geez, you know, Medicare, our seniors are on it, and it's efficient, et cetera. People forget that Medicare recipients spend a lot of money buying supplemental programs to get services that is not provided. So people really need to understand the real difference between market choices versus a state-run program. And even the title, what we talked about, that's being used and by the advocates as the public option, I actually choose another word. This is a state-run health insurance program that is looking to compete with our private marketplace and saying that the state can do the job better than our health insurers that are in the private marketplace. And that is one of the fundamentals for me that I really am eager, not that I'm opposed one way or the other, but I am very suspicious that anything that the state runs can be equally efficient and reflecting the real market needs. So I'm eager to find out more about this. And the more I look into it, the solution is paint a rosy picture and that we have a actuarial analysis, quote unquote, by surveys, et cetera, and we're going to tax other people to equate this solution. They may not call it a tax, Melissa, but it's called an assessment on private insurance programs, and that to me is equally challenging and a non-starter for me.
Well, yeah,
we
like how are we paying
to tax people?
Right. So, like, how are we paying for this public option? Like, immediately to me, I think like, okay, yeah, make insurance more affordable, which we need. I'm not disagreeing with that. Trust me, I'm not at all. But to offer this option to people, I have to imagine someone's going to get screwed over. Like, how are we paying for this?
Well, it really is increasing cost and redistributing, you know, states' redistribution of people's income and tax funds to balance out. And the other problem is we don't operate in a vacuum. The advocates take great pride that we will be the first in the country to initiate this kind of a plan. And they're looking to Washington from a standpoint of the new Affordable Care Act under the Biden administration to really be the poster child in some cases in this. But the problem is we have to compete with 49 other states for businesses and cost. And we are the insurance capital of the world. We have incredible number of employees with three of their major insurers, Aetna, Cigna, and United Healthcare. If we put this marketplace and these kind of government constraints and taxation, we're going to get retaliation from every other state in the country in imposing these kind of taxes. It will literally drive the private marketplace insurance business out of business. And maybe that's a goal. Maybe that's a goal to drive out our private market health insurance business so that it can be a state-run and federal-run program. To me, I don't trust the government to run anything efficiently.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and you bring up a really good point, Senator Tony Huang. You know, this process seems to be blunt. It takes brokers out of the equation. When I was looking up a 2018 state report for Connecticut, there are approximately 60,000 insurance carrier and related full-time employees in Connecticut alone. And that may sound like not a lot to some people, but again, you're looking at tens of thousands of people who could be out of a job because of this public option. Do the Democrats realize that?
They will say it will not lose jobs, but the real
That's not true, though. It's
not only real facts, but it's also the perception in the marketplace. And look, I don't trust the state to run anything efficiently. The state should be a collaborative partner with private markets and creating a public-private dynamic. That being said, we obviously need to do a better job because the latest report, employment report, has literally the state of Connecticut dead last in the nation in jobs and income growth. Why would you, in this climate, try to institute a program that is untested, that may be full of holes in regards to the realities of market forces, and impose that on Connecticut businesses and taxpayers? And the problem is, you talk about equity. My goodness, we're creating a public pool. That's what it's called. But you know what? The state employees are exempt from that pool, Melissa. It really is a remarkable inequity that if you're saying, let's open up the pool, let's get everybody into it, but boy, you know, we're gonna exempt the state employees union
into
a separate pool.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to manage that, undercut that risk assessment and the quality program that they have.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's about fairness, it's about transparency, and the fact is, as I said in the beginning, health care insurance and health care is an emotionally and deeply personal issue.
Yeah.
You cannot run the calculations based upon theory and actuarial numbers. People make healthcare decisions because it's their loved ones. And as a result, healthcare costs can be extremely high and complicated. For them to say, let's pool everything, and the reality is the current partnership plan that was in place under the controller right now has been shown by the Office of the Budget in the state of Connecticut, a budget objective office. They have shown that partnership plan right now to be in the red. And you know what happens when that plan goes into the red? It's not the insurance companies that's at risk. It's the Connecticut taxpayers
right.
that's at risk.
Exactly. And Senator Tony Huang, unfortunately, we have run out of time. But really quickly, there's a public testimony happening. I've told my listeners that my father is going to be involved as one of the local brokers talking about this and some of the things that people should know about. How can people listen in if they want to give testimony or anything? How do they do that?
They can go to the website, CTN, they can just type in Connecticut-network.com and it'll broadcast it. But they can go to cga.ct.gov to get all the information for all the other bills that may be forthcoming. Believe me, the lack of transparency is a pattern and it's a disturbing one. And I will do my best to try to create information and transparency for people. But I think what I'll do is I will throw this information onto my website, legislative website. It is Senator Huang, HWANG.com, and we'll put it on there so people, if they want to sign up, you can do it through Zoom testimony, or you can submit written testimony so that your thoughts and perspectives can be heard.
Senator
in
Huang,
a true
yeah.
democracy.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. I think the most educated, I think the people who vote and are the most educated, I think make some of the best decisions. So I appreciate that and the transparency. Thank you so much and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
Have a great
it. Day. Thanks, you too.
An insider's look at local law enforcement. Officer Mike DeVito checks in with Melissa in the morning on WICC 600.
We have virtually allowed our police officers no way of protecting us when a car theft happens. And I think criminals are taking advantage of that. So I wasn't sure if that's being looked at on a state level because it's a problem.
Yeah, I think that analysis is 90% wrong. There's definitely been a spike in crime. There's definitely been a spike in carjackings. I'm afraid that's true in Connecticut. I'm afraid that's true in 49 other states, some of which had a police accountability. No, they didn't have a police accountability bill. I think some of that's related to the fact that too many of our kids aren't in school. What we have to do there, our police they're not sitting back. They're not waiting. They're being aggressive and.
So this was a little bit of the snippet from last week's interview with Governor Ned Lamont, and it was brought to my attention about 2 months ago from Officer Mike DeVito, why we're seeing such an uptick in car thefts and in personal belongings being stolen, purses, things like that. And Officer DeVito, I don't know if you heard the interview with Governor Lamont, but that comment alone out of a 15-minute interview got so much response from our listeners. I wanted to dive into it again. First of all, good morning. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So when the governor says the reason we're seeing an uptick in car thefts and purse snatches is because kids are just not in school as much because of COVID, bogus, cop out, what do you think of that?
Well, I don't like to ever assess such a dominant number to anything. You know, we don't want to say always, never, all the time.
Sure.
And I think 90% is pretty close to almost, you know, saying it's, you know, a lock. And so I don't think there's a number of reasons you can attribute to it. Boredom is not one. I'm sorry. Crime has been and always is really, you know, is opportunity is huge. So yes, they have a little more time on their hands, but these crimes are being committed at, you know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, 6-7 o'clock in the evening, on the weekend. So the fact that they're not in school, I'm not essentially buying that. Like I said, the opportunity for victory, and it's a terrible analogy. How about this? The opportunity for success, and success meaning, you know, accomplishing the crime and not being caught or certainly not being adjudicated,
mm-hmm.
certainly is clearly favors the young perpetrator. And that it is what it is. I'll give you an example. This is just a snippet in crime in Connecticut. So Saturday night at the mall in Milford, there's two pretty violent purse snatchings, like a 58-year-old lady and her 63-year-old husband tried to intervene. They were both injured. A purse was taken, and then another violent altercation not too far away and not too far away time-wise either. Committed by the same parties. We're very, very confident. Now, to show you how confident and brazen they are, we backtrack, watching video. This is why he is partly right, where we're not sitting back. So although we may not be, you know, chasing cars, we're still trying to do our job. So we spent several hours with several officers and street crime officers delving through film and video, and we found out that they came to the mall in a 2019 vehicle, locked it, walked into the mall, walked through the mall, sat down in the food court and ate, and then left the mall and committed these crimes. Pretty brazen, right? And of course, I will add, the car was stolen out of a jurisdiction the day before, still had the plates on it, still had the key, the mm-hmm. fob, and chirping it. That's pretty confident and pretty brazen. I was never a criminal. Certainly have investigated many, but, man, I would know
that's
that
pretty
I would
bold.
That I would want to get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
very,
pretty bold.
Very confident in walking through countless cameras.
Yeah.
Walking by, sitting in the food court with multiple cameras. We watched the whole thing, right down to the items that they were eating and drinking
wow.
and which garbage pails we threw them in so we could seize those. So we're still doing things. It's not, we're not chasing them on the highway, but we actually, because this involved more than just property crime, we did try to chase them. We did try to pursue them, and we were finally, they forced one of our officers, isn't this funny? And again, it's probably a poor choice of words. Ironic is better. They forced one of our officers off the road into a curb, and his tire popped.
Wow.
Does that sound like bored
right,
young
like,
people?
Like,
no.
Yeah, you know, and I have to say too, Officer DeVito, and I know that this is probably more of a personal. I'm really tired of. I feel like the everyday person being blamed. Like so in this interview, for anyone who missed it, you can go to our website. You can hear it on the podcast. Again, it comes back to the everyday person. Like, hey, don't leave your car unlocked. True, we shouldn't. And hey, don't leave your car running. Sure, but like, how do you explain these two people who were just at the mall? Like, what? Leave your purse behind? Like, I don't understand. Like, at what point do we get defended at all? Like, at what point is it like, hey, you know what? People are taking advantage of the system right now, and really nice everyday people who are just trying to live their lives are being persecuted for it because we leave our cars unlocked in our driveways, which is something we've done for generations. I'm not saying it's okay, but I am saying that I feel like the answer is always, well, it comes back to you. You left your car unlocked, so you deserved it almost. And it's like, wait, you're kidding, right? Like, I don't know. It's very, very frustrating that always it comes back right. to like, well, hey, we can't really fix the accountability bills. So really, it comes down to you just got to be more responsible. You've just got to be more of a police. And it's like, you know what? That's kind of, to me, a cop-out. I'm wondering what can be looked at to even find a middle ground. Like, look, I also don't believe that people are just bored, so they decide, let's break the law this year. Let's do it. To me, I've got to imagine there's got to be a middle ground there where police can do more with their jobs.
Right. I think it's I agree with that. So if you look at my point, you know, not personally, but professionally, I am, you know, in charge of a police academy where I train officers throughout the state. We're starting an academy shortly, and I'm responsible in training these officers correctly. So they need to understand what they can and can't do. And what the current officers are asking is, when is this, not when, but, you know, can't you just see that this is no longer just property crime and it's turning into violent, you know, robberies and purse snatches? And the answer is that, listen, we're not going to be able to start chasing cars again. I get that. The public doesn't want that. There's statutes that prohibit that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we can do and what lawmakers can do is they need to hold when young people under 18-year-olds commit a crime, there needs to be something more than – it's not even a slap on the wrist. It's really just a open your hand. We're going to gently drop a piece of paper in your hand. You're going to have to go to court in New Haven or Hartford or Bridgeport, a juvenile court in – you know, 2-3 weeks or whatever. It's so the way the crime system is set up, and whether it not even crime behavioral system is set up is the crime is the, you know,
it's almost like in favor of the criminal,
right? With your kids, and you tell your kids to come home 5 minutes late for their curfew, they're not going to go out next weekend. So they take that into mind. But if you tell young people, and not that we're telling them, but the proof is in the pudding. If you commit this and you steal 10 cars and you do finally get caught by the police, nothing's going to happen. Don't worry about it. And that's really the truth. So what can happen or what needs to change? There needs to be listen, I'm not asking people to go to jail for years and years and years, but there still needs to be a little bit more on the backside to discourage this behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Or else it's not going to stop. And like you said, listen, the stolen car, if you leave your car running in front of the gas station, that's partly, you know,
your fault.
Have done that.
Sure,
As far as walking through the shopping centers in the malls,
give me a break.
What I told you happened Saturday night, it's not a one-time thing. You read the papers, watch, listen to the news feeds. This is happening in all jurisdictions. That's why our listeners need to be very careful when they're exiting stores and grocery stores and gas stations,
yeah.
And even their hairdresser, whatever. Be careful because cars are rolling through these parking lots looking
for opportunity. All right. Well,
yeah, and those aren't property crimes.
Yeah, exactly. Officer DeVito, thank you so much for coming on this morning talking about this. And I know we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob Donovan is back with us. He is our marriage consultant here on the show, and we're diving into part two. Is it a good idea to move in with your significant other before marriage, or does that lead to divorce a lot quicker? Bob, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Good morning to you.
Good morning. So I know last week, just to kind of recap, we looked at the fact that so many different institutions have been doing research on this marriage versus just living together and sort of the correlation there, why we dive into it. I earlier in the show talked about the four different types of couples that decide to move in together. We talked about like the normal next step. We talked about testing the relationship, getting out of bad situations like family or other roommates, or people who are just engaged or already planning a wedding. So why not get into the whole living together situation ahead of time? So today we kind of want to dive more into this. What do you want to specifically focus on for this part two?
Yeah. So one thing is that, again, there's a lot of research. People have studied this, these institutions. But, you know, as you know, my wife and I have worked in this field for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. We've actually counseled close to 200 couples that were planning on getting married. So we got a little experience with this. And probably over the 200 couples, you know, 30 to maybe 40% we find are cohabitating. So it is something that we face. And one thing I've heard a lot, and you did reference it really nicely, is about one reason, and I would say I think it's a myth, is couples say that they're going to live together to test the relationship. And on the outside, it makes sense. But I found a fascinating article in the New York Times by Meg Joy. She's a clinical psychologist at the University of Virginia. So she's credible. This is not, you know, Bob Smith on the street here. This is, you know, a clinical psychologist. She said that her research suggests that couples who cohabitate and use it to test their relationship are most at risk for future poor relationship quality and eventual relationship dissolution. And she cites the Pew Research Foundation that found 58% of married adults say their marriage is satisfying, while 41% of cohabitating say the same. So there's a significant difference. She also cited 78% of married adults, they say they feel closer to their spouse than adults that cohabitate, say 55%. So that does support what she's saying. And you know what's so funny? Like, I thought that, but I couldn't put my finger on it. So I found that, again, couples think that testing their relationship, this is going to help. It does not.
Well, Bob, so I don't know if I'm right in saying this at all, but to me, when you say I'm moving in to test the relationship, to me, that sounds like a prenup. So I know some people believe in prenups. We do not. We did not sign a prenup. We have no plans of doing that ever in our lifetime. Derek and I don't believe in prenups because to me, I feel like, and I could be wrong, but I feel like you are dooming the relationship before it even gets started. When you say, hey, there's a part of you that I don't trust if, you know, down the line you want to screw me over, basically, to put it bluntly, let's sign a piece of paper to make sure that that doesn't happen. That's how I kind of feel if you are moving in together and you want to just test if, in fact, this is the person you should be with. Like, yeah. I think it kind of sets you up for failure a little bit.
You're totally right. Yeah, basically, it's conditional, right? It's
conditional.
Right. Even a prenup. I had one couple, and he came from a wealthy family, and she did not. And his family put pressure on him to discuss this with her, and they came to see me. And I said, man, like, if you sign this and if this is what you're entertaining, you've got this option of divorce. You're saying that if divorce happens, this is optional for us. So they've kind of opened that window already.
Right.
Where divorce is an option. But wait, once you say that, boy, the marriage commitment just is not solid. So, so yeah, that's true. That is totally true. You know, the other couple things I found, and I want to give you a couple examples because, again, we've faced this for about 15 years now. One of the big issues that I have seen personally is that the commitment level to move in versus the commitment level of marriage is very different.
Yes.
Is very different. Marriage
requires. Thank you for saying that.
Oh, it requires such a level of commitment like nothing else. And, you know, there's something about vows. And when you even if you stand before a justice of the peace, you stand and you make a vow versus, oh, let's live together. We can save some money and test our relationship or whatever. So I think there's this level of commitment that just doesn't happen when you decide to cohabitate. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The other thing I found is this whole thing of red flags. You know, we're big on red flags, which is basically when you observe unhealthy emotional behavior, you know, controlling, anger, insecurities, blaming, things like that. when you are living together, generally two things happen. You generally miss those things, or if you see them, you're too far into the relationship to break
away.
It off.
Yep. Yep.
To walk away. Mm. I've seen that. In fact, we had a couple at our house that I saw that. Like, it's so obvious, these red flags. And they lived together because they were a little bit older. Economically, it made a lot of sense. But I met with him, and I said, you know, I see these red flags. Do you? I didn't say I didn't think you'd marry. That's not my responsibility. But I did point out these red flags, and he didn't agree with me.
Mm.
And they were divorced in 3 years.
Wow.
Because they were unwilling
to
break
see
it off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's this other couple that we love these guys, Desiree and William. That's not their name, but love these guys. And he just saw economic feasibility all over this relationship. And
sure.
I looked in her eyes, and she wanted to be married so bad. And she waited, and you waited, and eventually, and they had some conflict issues, but I mean, nothing major. And we did learn later that they did break it off. And I remember saying that breakup would have occurred way earlier if they weren't living together. But mm-hmm. she hung on and hung on and hung on.
Mm-hmm.
So it does impact. It does impact the relationship. And this last couple, I'll call them Ramon and Sandra, like, they were messy. Boy, these guys were really, really messy. And they were a little older, both living separately. And they had every reason to cohabitate, every reason. And they chose not to because they had just some stuff to work out. And they did. They saw a counselor. We actually gave them a marriage mentor. And they worked their issues, and they got married last year, and they're doing amazing.
Mm.
And what strikes me about these guys is, according to the world standards, they had every reason to cohabitate.
Yeah,
they really did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if they did, I guarantee you, they would not have probably worked as hard as they did on getting healthy. So it is a fascinating discussion. It really
mm-hmm.
is.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, Bob, I think it really does come down to that why factor. Why are you moving in together? I think that's a big thing. And Bob, I think if there are people who are either in a situation where they've moved in and it was not the right idea, or they're debating it, or they have a family member who's debating that and they think, I see the red flags, but they don't. If they want to reach out to you, Bob, how do they connect with you off the air?
Yeah. So that'd be great. So that those discussions, which I do have often, actually, would be via email, bdonovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, @blackrock.org.
All right. Well, we appreciate it, Bob. Thank you so much. And we'll talk again in a few weeks.
Okay, Melissa, take care.
Thanks, you too.